And as I promised you in the beginning of the show, we have an amazing guest for the second hour. His name is Mark Myers. He's a music historian. He is a critically acclaimed author. He's done a number of books. He's got a brand new one called Rock Concert, an oral history as told by the artists, backstage insiders, and fans who were there. It just came out this past week on Grove Atlantic. And it's a great read. I haven't had a time to go all the way through it yet. I've kind of perused some of the pages, and I'll tell you, I can't wait to curl up with the actual book when I get it in hand. Mark, are you there?
I am, Tom. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you, and I got to tell you that you are like my hero, and I haven't even met you yet. I've just been kind
of... The best kind of hero.
Perusing your, I've been a journalist for about 40 years. I've appeared in a couple of different books and things and magazines, but you are the guy whose career I aspired to. You've met so many folks, you've interviewed so many, and what I've read of this book is just so detailed, without going into too much detail, that you know, it's like watching paint dry or something. I mean, you keep us hooked, and some of these artists that you've talked to are pretty amazing, and even the sons and daughters of some of the folks that are no longer with us. Let's start off with the fact that this story actually begins 3,400 years ago, and you introduce us to that.
In prehistoric times. You know, getting to your earlier point moments ago, Tom, I bore easily. I mean, if things aren't exciting, my interest just drops straight off. And, you know, when I write, I'm always writing for that reader who gets bored very quickly. So thanks for your comment, because I worked really hard on that thing so that it just reads like a Harley just taken off. I mean, it's just constant drama. So I'm glad you picked up on that.
What I've been able to get through so far, it is an easy read. I mean, it flows well. You do a lot of chronological history. You introduce the average fan to a lot of folks they might not have known who are intricate in the construction of what we call rock and roll.
Yeah, it spans from 1950 to 1985. And the Rock Concert has roots in R&B, of course, and it goes back even further than that. But, you know, starting around 1950 is when the concerts that we can sort of look at and consider as rock concerts begin in Los Angeles. And then it sort of spreads across the country and things twist and turn, but mm-hmm. it does run that 35-year period. You know, and what fascinated me is how something that began in a sweaty arena held for boxing became a $9 billion industry. It's a fascinating journey from one point to the other.
Right. One of the things that I was happy to see, and you mentioned L.A. just now, but to me the first rock concert was the Coronation Ball and the Moonlight matinees that Alan Freed, who is a personal hero of mine.
It's actually a myth.
Really?
Yeah, it's a myth. I don't know how that myth got started in Cleveland. Maybe it was because the Rock Hall is there and it was needed to build that up. But that concert that was held in Cleveland, that Moondog Coronation Ball, lasted only about 40 minutes. It didn't last at all because the fire department shut it down. There were just too many people jammed in there, and it wasn't nearly as, to me, my book opens with what I believe is the real first rock concert, which takes place in 1951 in the fall,
right,
literally 70 years ago. And that's a midnight concert that was held at the Olympic Auditorium with Big J. McNeely and a whole bunch of other people. But what made that concert fascinating is that it was integrated, number one, which was almost unheard of in 1951. And then also because Bob Willoughby, a Hollywood still photographer, decided when he heard it on the radio or heard the DJ hyping it, grabbed his cameras and went down and photographed it. And the images that we see from this concert, you know, remind us of our own first rock concert, the awe and the euphoria of the audience.
If you watch some of the rock and roll films, like, say, American Hot Wax with Tim McIntyre as Alan Freed, that, I think, is what perpetuates, which I always subscribe to, that Alan Freed pretty much invented the rock concert. I stand corrected by your book. I think that film is where I got that idea.
Well, you know, what's interesting is Alan Freed does do something rather, he does several things rather important for the history of the rock concert, but it's not so much in Cleveland. It's when he moves to New York in 1954, he holds these super concerts at the Brooklyn Paramount that run for, they're really kind of interesting. They run for 7 days or 10 days in some cases.
Wow.
Over the school holidays in Easter, at Christmas time, Labor Day. And if you were a kid, if your mom made you a couple of sandwiches and you tossed it in a brown paper bag, if you showed up at this at the Brooklyn Paramount like at 9 a.m. and got in, you could stay right around the clock and watch these acts over and over again and see feature movies. It was free once you got in. If you left, you couldn't get back in. But you know, so many kids went. And so many kids were turned on to rock and roll at that point. And you'd see Chuck Berry, and you'd see Little Richard, and you'd see Fats Domino and the Platters and Frankie Lyman. I mean, it was act after act after act, and the kids were screaming. And again, that also was an integrated concert.
Right.
Rare back then.
We got to give a shout-out to not only Alan Freed, but folks like Bill Randall and Dewey Phillips. These were pioneering radio guys. Of course, you had the black radio stations, the urban stations, with B.B. King and a lot of the blues artists that would play live and play platters. But it was those guys that went on to break the breakdown, so to speak, and integrate. They were called Race Records at the time, as you recall.
Before 1949. 1949, Billboard changed its chart name from Race Records to Rhythm and Blues.
Wow. So these guys really broke the mold and turned on a lot of the Caucasian audience that was listening to Patti Page and Frank Sinatra still and people like that, and turned them on to Little Richard and Fats Domino and Chuck Berry and Lloyd Price and all those guys back then. So a big shout out to those guys who pioneered the radio world that is now, other than here on NPR, is so corporate and constricted. I wish we could go back to those days in so many ways. Thank God for the internet, I guess.
Radio, Tom, was fundamental. I mean, what happens in the early 1950s is that parents get television sets for the first time. And to keep their kids out of their hair because they want to watch TV, parents buy their kids portable record players for their bedrooms to keep them in their rooms. Their friends come over, they don't want them, in the living room where they're watching TV. So the kids got portable record players in the rooms. Parents also buy them smaller radios. Suddenly smaller tube radios are available, and they put those in their kids' rooms. And what happens at night is the kids don't go to sleep, as we both know, because we both probably spent a lot of time listening to transistor radios under our pillows growing up.
Right.
But the kids are working the dial at night. Brothers are in the if brothers are rooming together or sisters, they're working the dial. And what they find is at the very ends of the dials are suddenly they find this grown-up music with a beat, big beat, and blues music, and they're finding all kinds of disc jockeys who are animated and create all of these, make-believe places that they're broadcasting from. And the kids' imaginations get flipped on, but because they're in their room where they're buying 45s, the kids discover rock and roll at the far reaches of the dial, rhythm and blues, and then, it goes from there. But it's just fascinating how rock and roll really, really comes of age or starts to enter kids' consciousness in the dark.
Right, exactly. And I was one of those kids with that AM radio under the pillow. I think we all were. I've got to ask you your opinion. It's been debated by scholars and historians for years and decades since rock and roll debuted. What would you consider the first real rock and roll song? And I ask that because I've always thought Rocket 88 was the first that I would call a rock and roll song by Jackie Brenston.
That's a tough question because all of these songs back then had elements. There's elements. Rock Around the Clock, if there's a rock and roll record that one considers rock and roll, but it doesn't do that well on the charts or nobody really hears it, is that really the first record, is it the first one to become a hit? Bill Haley was one of the first to have a hit in 1953 with a quote rock and roll record. So it's kind of hard to sort of say this is it because mm-hmm. there's just too many variables to consider. Laurie Miss Claudie, for me, is probably the first rock and roll record, and I'll tell you why. It's the first record to use a backbeat, and that was recorded in New Orleans with Fats Domino on piano. And, you know, it's a record, if you listen to it, Earl Palmer on drums is playing a backbeat, which is, for listeners who don't know what a backbeat is, it has a very strong two and four. Mm-hmm. One, two, three, four. So, you know, there you've got the backbeat, you've got all the things in place that are at the heart of rock and roll. And that's, you know, that's of course Lloyd Price.
Right. Yeah, who we just lost recently. What a great guy he was and the amazing stories he had. I assume you had a chance to interview him over the years.
I did, yeah. And I actually did, you know, the anatomy of a song column that I write for the Wall Street Journal monthly. Some years back, I interviewed him on Lordy, Miss Claudie. He gave me the complete breakdown of how that song came together. And, you know, once you know how that song came together, that Fats Domino was brought in there, and that you've got a different kind of piano being played, and you've got this backbeat, that to me is where the DNA starts.
Okay.
And listeners can go on to YouTube, and again, Lloyd Price, Lordy, Miss Claudie, that's really the boilerplate for early rock and roll.
Right, and so many artists have covered it, the Buckinghams here in Chicago, Elvis, the Beatles, they've all done that song, but
exactly.
Listen to Lloyd. It's interesting that we're talking about the roots of rock, and I know we want to get to the concert stuff, but a lot of the younger rockers, and when I say younger, I mean 40 and under, don't realize that guitar was not the primary instrument in the early days. It was saxophone. And then later, piano. You mentioned Fats Domino, Little Richard, Jerry Lee. It wasn't until a few years after rock started that we got the guitar up front. And I think, I mean, there was a lot of people, Cliff Gallup with the Blue Note, Scotty Moore with Sun Records, Luther Perkins. Those guys contributed a lot, but I think Chuck Berry was the reason the guitar came forefront. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. You know, Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley, you know,
yeah.
55. It's really the Chicago scene, the Chicago electric blues scene, where you've got guys with portable amps and speakers, and they plug in and they're able to play. First of all, the saxophone was an expensive instrument. So, you know, there was a problem there. Kids couldn't really, you know, get a saxophone and emulate their rock star idols. But more important, you could sing. You couldn't sing while you were playing the saxophone.
That's true.
But you could sing and you could move around on stage the way Chuck Berry did with the electric guitar. And also you could, you know, it was easily transportable. You just put the speakers and the amp in the trunk, and you put the guitar in the car, and off you go to the next gig. It wasn't a big production.
Mm-hmm. And like Bob Seger said, all of Chuck's children are playing his licks, and that's where we got the Eddie Van Halens and the Jimi Hendrixes and the Johnny Winters and all these great guys that have come along later. And, of course, the Beatles kick-started everything all over again in 64, February of that year, and that, of course, is documented very well. Let's talk, for those of you that just tuned in, I'm talking with Mark Myers. He is a music historian, journalist, critically acclaimed author. His new book is Rock Concert, An Oral History as Told by the Artists, Backstage Insiders, and Fans Who Were There. It is now officially out, correct?
It'll be out on the 9th,
okay.
Next week, yeah.
Oh, I just got the early edition, and I guess I thought it was out already.
No, but it's pre-orderable, and the sooner you order it, the sooner you're going to get it.
All right. And that is available where?
Everywhere. Amazon. Yep. If you go to London, you get it in London. You can go to Australia. It's published there. It's being published simultaneously in quite a few countries.
And it's a quick read in many ways because it's only about, 340 pages?
Yeah, it's about 400 pages.
Okay.
But the big thing is it's chronological, starts in 1951, it moves forward, and it's fast as a dart. I mean, there's nothing. I mean, from what I hear, it's very difficult to put down.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that. And like I said, I just got it a couple days ago, and I haven't had time to digest it all. So I've skimmed through different chapters and names that I knew. And I like the fact that you actually tell the story in many of the artists and many of the backstage guys and the family members' own words. You actually take, it seems like, excerpts of your interviews and drop them in so
yeah,
that they're telling the story.
That's important because what I want is I want you to have the intimacy of hearing from these people. So if I'm speaking with Mike Stoller of Lieber and Stoller, or I'm talking to Roger, you know, I'm talking to Bob Weir of The Dead, or I'm talking to Alice Cooper, I want the reader to feel as though those people are talking to them,
mm-hmm.
and that they're not having to wade through my writing. What I've done in places is, of course, I've added italicized paragraphs where people need to know what's changing or what's causing things to change. But when you're hearing about what actually happened, you're hearing it directly from the eyewitness. It's a fascinating device where if I disappear, if the reader feels like they're just listening to Alice Cooper, then I've done my job.
Right. And you're kind of like the guy that creates the segue that flows the story to the
Correct.
Next chapter.
Yep.
That said, the book is done. The book is being ordered. It's coming out. How long in the making? How long has it taken you to compile all these amazing interviews? And I ask because I've got 40 years of tape and digital and everything else, and I look at that and it's mind-boggling. And I'm trying to think of a guy like you who says, okay, here's a mountain of 40 years of interviews, some of these people long past. How do you take that and turn it into a book?
Well, that's what I do. It's sort of like, how do you make food in a restaurant, or how do you make an air conditioner? My specialty is reporting, getting great information, then distilling that information so that the reader is engaged, and then, you know, editing and polishing it so that it's dramatic. So it's not just engagement, that the reader is literally on pins and needles or at the edge of their seat, and they can't believe what they're learning from these people who are doing the talking in the book. More than 90 sources in there.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, you know, numbers can be daunting. The listener should know that it moves so fast. I wrote it so it would read like a movie.
Would you or are you considering doing like a podcast version where you actually take the taped excerpts and make it something like an oral history, literally hearing it?
There's a bunch of ways to go. I wish I had three of me because I'm so, I mean, I write for four sections of the Wall Street Journal on rock and music and the arts. As it is, I don't know, is it autumn yet? Is it still summer out? I haven't been out of my home office in weeks. So, those kinds of things, if an opportunity comes up, obviously, it's something to consider. But as it stands, I just want readers to have a great time with this book because it really is. It's like a documentary, but in words.
Okay, let's play something. You sent me a couple of different clips here of special concerts that you feel were outstanding for various reasons, and we've queued up the Bob Dylan. Now, this is pretty much a no-brainer. This, I assume, is when he plugged in for the first time at Newport, right?
Yeah.
And why did you choose this? Why is this such a pivotal moment? I mean, if you're not a Dylan or a folk fan, why was this important to the rock world, because Dylan was folk at the time.
Yeah, at the end of this night, Dylan has basically invented rock without the roll. You see the start of singer-songwriters, you see the start of album rock, you see the start of artists writing their own music and creating their own music, not bringing in ringers or the Wrecking Crew or studio musicians. And Dylan has everything to do with that, but what most people think of about this night, based on my reporting, is quite different than what we know. And we can talk about that on the other side,
okay,
if you want. But I'll fill you in on what actually caused this to happen.
Okay, this is Bob Dylan, a historical moment, live at Newport, like a Rolling Stone.
Thought they were all in you. Everybody that was hanging out, now you don't talk so loud. Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging your next meal. How does it feel? How does it feel? To lose. You're invisible now. You got no secrets to hide.
How does it feel? Rolling Stone live at Newport, changing of the sound, changing of the guard, so to speak, of folk music. Bob Dylan, idol of all the folkies, the Pete Seeger, the Woody Guthrie era folk singers, and suddenly plugged in and became an icon of rock and roll. My guest is Mark Myers. He is a music historian, author of the new book, Rock Concert and Oral History, as told by the artists, backstage insiders, and fans who were there. It is out the 9th of this month. You're getting a little preview of what we're talking about here. We're going to play a couple more cuts during the show. But, Mark, you said you had a backstory on that. Tell us about it.
Yeah, there were three rules in folk at this point in time. No drums. You've never heard of, you know, Peter, Paul, and Mary Me. You just don't see a drummer in any folk group prior to this group on stage that night. No drums, no electric guitar. Everything is acoustic in folk. And most importantly, no ego. But the Beatles arrived in 64, a year earlier, and were tearing up with Beatlemania, with their tours. The frenzy over the Beatles was just enormous. And Dylan, who had been toured in England earlier in the year, I think it was March or April of 65, comes back and he's sort of, you know, he's dressed swinging London. I mean, he sees what's going on. He's very keen on what's happening and that there's a new youth movement happening. And when he gets back, he goes to Newport, but he feels he's a little bigger because he's got a hit out and, you know, he's increasingly popular. And he decides, you know, I'm actually special. I'm mm-hmm. more special than everybody else here. And the elders, you know, the traditional folkies, they stick him in the middle between two traditional groups. I think it was Cousin Emmy and Sea Island Singers. And he felt he should have been closing that night and not being placed in the middle. Now, add to this the fact that the elders had insulted the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, belittled them when they appeared on stage the day before. Dylan wasn't happy about that either, because he understands that the Beatles and electrified instruments are the future.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is that he cranks, they get up on stage, and Dylan and the band, they just crank up their amps. They crank it up louder than it should have been because the equipment couldn't handle it. But he cranks it up because it's not so much they want volume or they want to play electric instruments. It's an ego play. Dylan feels he's special. He's more special than everybody else there because he's selling more records and his message is getting through and he's a bigger deal. And he's not being treated that way. And he cranks it up to sort of teach the elders a lesson that this is the new sound. I'm playing the new sound. I really don't care what people think.
I never looked at it that perspective, but I can see that. I can see that. Now, Dylan, you know, has been a forefront leader in many ways. I mean, even today, he has gone on and played his songs different ways, reinvented it from show to show, and now he's playing keyboards and not even up front singing like he was. What are your thoughts on Dylan, his evolution from that point, and how he's never been pigeonholed?
I just think he's a poet artist who not only understands that idiom, folk and rock, but he also understands how to be special. I there's not many people like that. You know, the Beatles, you know, the Stones, Dylan. It's a handful of people that understood how to be cool. And being cool as a rock star required certain things, you
mm-hmm.
know, required a constant change, especially as a performer. You know, it's constant change. You had to seem aloof. You couldn't seem approachable or accessible or even likable. But you had to deliver 110% to your audience. And the cool factor is really what Dylan was all about. And I don't think it's hard to think of. It's hard to think of rock stars who were more cool, and even today, than Dylan, just in terms of his aloofness and his sort of straight-faced delivery.
If you go back and you watch, and I know this is one of your top 50 documentaries, you watch Bob Dylan, Don't Look Back. He is the essence of cool, with the shades on and his hair all tussled and his sitting at the piano there, and Pennybaker really captured what Bob Dylan was all about just a year or so after the concert we just heard.
Yeah, the only other figure I can think of that is on is that sort of same has that or perhaps where Dylan got this from. The only person you can compare him to is Miles Davis in jazz. This coolness and aloofness, but enormous sensitivity and prettiness in the playing, and with Dylan, the tenderness and the sensitivity of the lyrics. But once the music's over, you've got this almost stone-like personality that is not accessible and doesn't want to be accessible and doesn't care if he's liked or not. He just wants to perform and reach audiences, but it's all in the lyrics. And with Davis, Miles Davis, it was all in the trumpet.
Right. Now, did you actually get a chance to interview Bob himself?
No.
I've tried for years. I've worked with Jacob and interviewed the Wallflowers and did a couple shows with them. Never. He's been my I don't know, you know, chalice, so to speak, to find. I've never been able to talk. Of everyone I've ever wanted to interview or meet, it was Bob Dylan, and never happened. I thought
you
maybe would you would have gotten
you
it.
You probably would have been disappointed. My guess is that, like Miles Davis, Bob Dylan's a pretty lousy interview. And when you read many of the interviews that he's done, you know, you never know what's being taken seriously. And, you know, you never know whether the reporter who's asking the questions is really up to the task. And, you know, there's no way in.
Right.
That's the thing with Dylan. And that's what you just need to understand. There's no way into that guy. That it's all in the art. It's all in the lyrics. And what you ask him and what he answers is irrelevant. Because ultimately it is about the music and it is about how those lyrics touch people, touch millions of people.
Given the fact that he would be such a sought-after interview and one that might be disappointing, of those that the many that you have interviewed over the years, are there one or two that you were the most excited or nervous to actually sit down with, someone that you approached with trepidation and it turned out to be a wonderful interview?
Well, I'm never nervous. I mean, this is what I do.
Okay.
You know, it's like flying a jet, flying an F-16. I mean, you know, you wonder how those guys are able to climb into that cockpit and fly that thing without crashing it, right? I mean, it's what they do. So this is what I do. But if you're asking me, you know, which interviews were particularly standout interviews, I would probably say George Martin, the producer of the Beatles. I interviewed him at his home in the Cotswolds in England. A few years back, and I would also say the 2 hours I spent with Joni Mitchell at her home in California in 2014, I believe.
Okay. How did you come to journalism? You have written multiple books. You have been, as you mentioned, Wall Street Journal. You've written for decades. And for the listeners, you can check in with Mark at jazzwax.com, where you write mostly on jazz. So when did you start being a journalist? Was it always music journalism? And how did you shift gears into rock and roll from being an astute jazz writer?
Wow, there's a lot of questions.
There's a lot of questions in there.
Yeah,
I apologize for that.
I would say as a child, I was first intrigued by journalism watching Superman on TV. I know that sounds ridiculous, but I didn't care about the guy in the cape. The guy who impressed me most was Clark Kent. And you know, the fact that he worked for the Daily Planet and that there were these deadlines and that people wrote things and they got printed and that whole thing sort of caught me pretty early. And then, you know, I started at the New York Times while in college, interning. And after college, remained in journalism because it's a passion of mine. And then through the years, I've written on real estate and finance and taxes and all kinds of things. And I've always wanted to be a rock writer. I mean, it was always a dream of mine. And that suddenly landed in my lap in 2010. And, you know, I would say for listeners, you know, almost no matter what you do, if you have passion for it, if you have enormous passion and tireless energy for it, things are going to work out for you. It's just the way it is.
Hmm.
Look at you, Tom, see?
Yeah, 40 years later, I wanted to be Larry Lujak when I started, and here I am on NPR doing interviews, not playing those hit records, you know.
But, well, you are. You still are. I mean, you know, NPR is the gold standard of radio. Everybody knows that.
That's
and,
true.
You know, to be in your seat at an NPR station just says it all about you. So, you know, it's passion. You bring enormous passion and intellect to what you do, and you know, same with me. And I think same with your listeners for what they do. It's, you know, for me, it's all about the audience. I want the reader of this book, Rock Concert, to have the greatest darn read they've ever had about rock and roll. I want this to be their the best book they've ever read on rock and roll and the rock concert. And that's what I put into it.
It's interesting because I did notice that you said your first concert was with a friend named Glenn about age 15. And it's interesting because mine was too. 1974, I was a 15-year-old eighth grader, and my school friend Glenn had an extra ticket to see George Harrison and friends at the Chicago Stadium.
Whoa.
And that inspired me to chase the lifelong addiction of rock and roll and music. So I thought that was a unique parallel with us.
Yeah, well, for me, it was Santana in 71 at the Felt Forum in New York. But, you know, the thing that's interesting about the rock concert, Tom, is that you can ask people, you know, what's your in-law's birthday? And they, you know, you get a shrug. And, you know, you can say, you know, what's the color of your first car? And probably a shrug. And, you know, where do you have the keys to your house? You know, do you know? And, you know, people might remember that, or, you know. But you ask somebody where about their first rock concert, and then they suddenly get into, like, I was here, and I got dressed in these clothes, and I went with this person. They know every single detail about that rock concert. And I think that's largely because there were only two kinds of celebrities, you know, when we were kids.
Mm-hmm.
And even today, to some extent, there's two kinds of celebrities. There's movie stars, and there's rock stars. And you don't usually see movie stars. You know, most people have never seen a movie star. I mean, you know, they've seen them in the movies, you've seen them on TV and on the screen, but you never have an intimate moment. You're never seeing them live, right? Either in a party or even while they're filming. You're not allowed on a set, and unless you're in the movie industry, you're not seeing anybody doing what they do. But for a rock star, you go to a concert and you get good seats, and you see these people for real. I mean, you're seeing Mick Jagger on stage for real. And I think for that, when people leave that, the rock star becomes a very personal celebrity, that they've seen somebody important, they've seen somebody special, and they saw them live, not on TV or on film. And that's a big deal for everybody.
Let's play another song. We've got several concert songs. We're not going to get to all of them. So let's, I got so many questions for you. We should have made this a 2-hour show, and maybe we can have you back to talk some more about it. Let's play another song. What would you like to play? We've got the David Bowie, Suffragette City, Pink Floyd, Rolling Stones, which of course was a landmark moment too, the Altamont Fest. And we've got the Teddy Pendergrass from Live Aid. So what would you like to play?
Why don't you play Bruce Springsteen's Badlands from the No Nukes concert in 1979?
Okay. We're going to do that. No Nukes, actually, Bruce's concert is going to be issued on vinyl coming out, I think, in a week or two.
Mm-hmm.
This is a perfect time song, the legendary No Nukes concert. And it just was the 40th anniversary of No Nukes. John Hall and all these folks wrote about nuclear power, and people said, oh, you know, it's the future, it's not going to matter. Well, look how many people are dealing with electric cars now and windmills because messages like the No Nuke concert inspired people to pursue alternate energy. So it just goes to show that rock and roll and rock artists can make change. And this is one of the songs from that landmark concert. No Nukes. We'll be back with Mark Myers after this.
In the night, we'll be so real. You spend your life waiting for a moment. It just
Bruce Springsteen coming at you live, Badlands, off the legendary No Nukes concert, and his full concert is going to be coming out on vinyl and CD. And I misspoke earlier; it was the 40th anniversary last year, 2020. The film came out in 1980, making it the 40th year. I've kind of lost track with all the crazy COVID pandemic stuff going on of what happened when, but my guest certainly knows. Mark Myers is chronological; he's a historian. And he's got a brand new book, The Rock Concert Oral History, that we're talking about. Mark, I've got to ask you, what's with the concerts and how they've changed, the evolution? And what I mean by that, I saw George Harrison for $8.50. I saw Elvis on May 20th, 1977, here in Chicago at the Stadium for $13.50. And I saw Kiss perform at the Parthenon Theater in downtown Hammond, Indiana for $3.75. You can't touch a ticket for under $80 to $100 now. What happened to concerts? Why isn't it like Alan Freed's days where the kids could be dropped off and spend an entire day?
Because the industry figured out how to monetize them. You know, what you have now, you know, back in those days, rock was in its earliest years. Rock, I don't mean rock and roll, but rock as we know it,
mm-hmm.
post-Dylan. And... you know, what you basically have is you have people who came along who said, look, why should people pay $250 to go see the Steelers, or why should they pay to go see the World Series for a fortune, or why should they pay $150, $60, $70, $80 to go see a Broadway show, and rock is supposed to be free, or $5 for a ticket? And they figured out ways to charge money for it. And when they started charging money for it, the technology got better, and you've got large screens and better audio, and it's a big event, and there's special effects, and pyrotechnics are going off and everything, you know, people want to go, and they want to go see the Stones, or they want to go see U2, but those concert tickets, they've figured out a way to, you know, charge much more money, and mm-hmm. nobody's putting a gun to anybody's head to force people to go to a concert. If you want to go to a concert, basically, you know, promoters are saying, this is what it's worth. And if you don't think that's what it's worth, don't go. They still sell out, by the way.
Right. Let me play devil's advocate. Back maybe 25 years ago, we started seeing sponsors of show. Charlie Daniels would go out and skull, chewing tobacco would sponsor him or whoever. And the theory was you're going to get to be pitched a product. You're going to get to see commercials on the big screens or see banners everywhere. And in exchange for that inconvenience, just like being at the movies, the ticket prices will remain low. But that didn't happen.
Cable, Tom, was supposed to be free, right?
In other That's words, true.
You were supposed to have no out. You were paying for cable, so there wasn't supposed to be any advertising on it. Like, when was the last time you saw no advertising on cable TV, right?
Good point.
You know, at the end of the day, if they can get away with it, they do it. But, you know, the other thing to keep in mind, the very important thing to keep in mind, is that back in the beginning, back when I say the beginning, 67, 68, again, I'm talking post-Dylan, the rock era, artists would record an album, and then they would tour the album. In other words, the album, you needed to go out and perform the album live for you to sell the album. And when the album sold, that's where everybody made money. And in the digital age, with downloading, with music being ripped for friends and burned and down, you know, music virtually free today because you can access everything on YouTube and Spotify,
mm-hmm.
the only way that artists can make money is on tour. The album is a lost leader. You know, a lost leader, for those who don't know what that means, is,
right.
you know, you're going to lose money on it, but it's going to make you money in other ways.
Right.
So if Bruce records an album today, or, you know, the Stones record an album today, that album is just there so that you go to see them on tour, because that's where they're going to make all their money. That's where they're going to come away with $60, $70, $80 million on tour, and the album is like they'd give it away, but if they could, but they charge for it anyway because you got to put a price on, you got to put some kind of price on it. But keep in mind, when people release an album today, what happens to it? Immediately, it's on YouTube for free, right? In
right.
tracks. So the music is a lost leader. It's just basically given away to make you want to go pay $250 for a ticket.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong on this, too, because this is what I've always heard, that the first $100 face value ticket was Hell Freezes Over. Don Henley and the Eagles said, well, we'll get come together if when Hell Freezes Over and we can charge $100 a ticket. Now, that's the story I heard. I don't know if that's folklore or what, but...
They didn't call the Eagles the corporate rock band for nothing. keep in mind, it's like... You know, if you buy a coat, if you get a really good coat, you got to spend a lot of money for it, right? If you get a Porsche, you got to pay money for it. If you get anything that's of real value today, you're probably spending money for it. And you don't mind because you know you're getting quality. And if people go see the Stones or they go see a top act, the odds are you're going to spend $250. I mean, you're going to be complaining all night long about how far away you are. Even if you're 100 rows from the stage, you're not close enough. And but you're going to get a good show. I mean, because these, you know, rockers work hard. I mean, these performers work their tails off to give you a great show. I don't know anybody who ever said, I spent $250 on the Stones and it was terrible. Or I spent all this money and the concert was a complete drag. I mean, there are cases where that is, you know, people do say that there are concerts that are duds. There's no doubt about it. But for the most part, you complain. The biggest complaint is how far, you're not close enough for the money you spent. But once the concert starts, you know, people are swept away.
Right, right. Is there anything that we haven't covered that you want to let people know about concert going?
So
or
much.
We have so much stuff that we haven't touched on. Like I said, I'd love
buy the book.
To book
All
you
I can
again.
Tell readers is if you buy my book, Rock Concert, is the only rock concert event this fall that doesn't require a mask. It's true. I mean, you know, if you want the rock concert experience, buy the book because you're going to get 35 years of it. And I stopped in 1985. You know, people ask me, why'd you stop in 1985? Rock goes on after that. Yeah, it does. But, you know, 1985, in my interviews, it kept coming up that 1985 was the last, Live Aid was the last old school rock concert put on by old school promoters. And the charge was like $35 a ticket. There were some $50 tickets. But for the most part, it's a break point. It's a break point. If I write, you know, I'll see if I'm going to break part two, you know, 1935 up until the current era. But for the most part, that was a good place to stop because everybody was talking. Everybody I interviewed about that concert was talking about how everything changed after that. Rock became more corporate after that.
Right. And the record business was falling apart in the 80s, and albums like Thriller saved us, basically.
Yeah.
And I was in the record business then. I am now. And that was a turnaround that we were looking at a very painful demise until Michael came out with Thriller. And then a few other big albums came out and, we found ourselves back in the saddle, so to speak, for a little while longer anyway.
Vinyl disappeared. Now vinyl is back.
Yep.
CDs are out now. I'm sure CDs will be back. At the end of the day, it's all about the music and how it makes you feel. And the beauty of music, like the beauty of spaghetti, is that everybody loves the music, everybody loves spaghetti, doesn't matter what your politics are, doesn't matter whether you're tall, short, fat, skinny, everybody loves spaghetti and rock and roll.
I love that analogy. It just matters what kind of sauce you want.
Exactly.
You are writing the jazz column still, multiple columns actually, for Wall Street Journal. You can keep up with Mark at jazzwax.com. What's next for you? Do you have another book in mind, or are you going to just focus on your columns?
I've got, believe it or not, my next book is due December 15th. In addition to writing three pieces for the Wall Street Journal this week, one of which is tomorrow's cover on the review section. If you buy the Wall Street Journal tomorrow, I have the cover story in the review section, and the title of it is How the Rock Concert Changed America.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, that'll give it to you. So I'm just, you know, it's constant production. My next book is due on the 15th. That'll be out in the fall of 2022.
And what's the topic of that?
I can't tell you yet.
Ah, okay.
I can't. Have me back and I will.
All right, we will do that. Mark Myers has been my guest. Let's close with one of the other songs that you have given to me here. What do you want to do?
Let's do David Bowie, Suffragette City at Santa Monica. In Santa Monica in 1972, one of the great performances of that song.
And I remember having David on this show many years back. He called from England. We did a long-distance interview.
Deal. That's a big deal.
It was. Well, thank you so much, Mark. Be safe.
Tom, it was an honor. Thank you so much for having me.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye. Hey, man. Hey, man. Hey, man. Well, my school, they
she had a sweet adventure. I mentioned, oh, no.